Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, a Sackville hospital is struggling to find the staff it needs, but hope is in sight.
It is somewhat twofold, but mostly the first point, and that's lack of staffing, physicians and nurses.
The high rate of inflation is putting pressure on food banks all over the country. It's their turn to ask for help.
So far, we're managing to meet it all. I'm not sure where the growth is going and what that's going to look like.
New Brunswick students crumble under debt. Boosting university funding could be a solution.
It affects a student when they graduate.
And it's forest season once again. Firefighters give us some tips on how to best protect our houses.
Most factors that will determine if your host survives or doesn't is inside of 10 meters of your own property.
A BC chocolatier sources her raw cacao from the Andean mountains of Ecuador and produces the love bar we crave for.
I am offering a type of medicine that can open the heart. This is what I think we really need more in our society is nourishing foods that make us feel good so that we can respond to each other in a much more positive way.
Welcome to Viewpoints.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakova in beautiful British Columbia. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI and get all our stories on canada-info.ca.
New Brunswick's public universities have released their budgets for the next year, and all of them seem to include another round of tuition hikes. That's bad news for New Brunswick students who graduate with debt. The student group tells the province it should boost university funding to reduce student debt. In Sackville, David Gordon Kosh speaks with Sedona Shandon, the head of the New Brunswick Student Alliance, about university financing student debt and the effects of inflation.
Earlier this year, Minister of Post-Secondary Education Trevor Holder announced that universities in New Brunswick will receive a 1.5% increase in operating grants from the province. The provincial government has also linked some additional funds to the performance of universities. For example, l'Université de Moncton will receive extra cash each year for graduating nurses above a baseline figure of 126. But groups representing university students and faculty say the Higgs government isn't going far enough to address longstanding issues, including high student debt and a legacy of reduced provincial funding that dates back more than 30 years. The New Brunswick Student Alliance has called for the province to increase basic operating grants by at least 3% annually. Sedona Shandon is the executive director of that group, which represents student unions at Mount Allison University, St. Thomas University, and the University of New Brunswick.
We are appreciative of the fact that they did increase it to 1.5%. However, we also recognize that it is a very small step and there is much further that we'd like to go. So in my point of view, you know, the New Brunswick Student Alliance is grateful for an increase somewhat, but we would like to see more done in the years to come.
Universities across Canada have faced a long-term decline in funding from provincial governments over the past several decades, according to the Federation of New Brunswick Faculty Associations. New Brunswick provincial government covered 80% of the cost of universities in the 1980s compared to just 57% today, according to that group. New Brunswick ranks fourth in the country for highest undergraduate tuition and mandatory fees, according to a report published last year by Higher Education Strategy Associates, a Toronto-based consultancy firm. Across Canada, nearly half of university students graduate with debt, but their average debt load varies by province. In Quebec, it's about $16,000, the lowest in the country. In Ontario and the Western provinces, the average debt load is closer to $30,000. Here in the Maritimes, the amount of debt tends to be around $40,000, the highest in the country.
It affects a student when they graduate. So if a student wanted to, you know, buy a house graduating and choose to settle in New Brunswick, it would be much harder for them to do so if there is that significant debt burden on them.
The provincial government announced in April that it will eliminate interest on provincial student loans beginning sometime this fall, following the lead of the other three Atlantic provinces. It's a policy change that the New Brunswick Student Alliance has been demanding for years. According to the provincial government, the move will cost the province about $5.5 million per year and will benefit some 65,000 borrowers. Meanwhile, at Mount Allison, which is among the most expensive public universities in the Maritime region, this year's 3% increase brings annual tuition to nearly $10,000 for full-time domestic students and closer to $20,000 per year for international students.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Food banks all over the country are feeling the pressure of added demand caused by the rise of inflation. The Kingston Food Bank is one of them. Partners in Mission Food Bank Executive Director Dan Irwin says that the food bank has seen demand increase by 19% this year compared to 2021. Canada's inflation rate is having a huge impact on consumers. Even if the food bank is still meeting community demands, they do wonder for how long. The actual demand has shocked us. It's unprecedented, adds Dan Irwin. The food bank doesn't have any choice but to also ask for help. It's currently accepting both monetary and food donations. More with Karim Mosna in Kingston, Ontario.
With the record inflation rate since the 80s, I just would like to see if that's been translating to a lot more demand at the food bank.
Yeah, the record inflation is definitely impacting households and it's impacting our demand. Last year was a record year for our food hamper distribution at 14,229. And this year, as of the end of May, we're up 19.7% over last year.
19.7% over last May?
Over last year entirely. No, it's year over year. So last year was a record year. And so far, as of the end of the year to date, as of the end of May, we're up 19.7% over last year's records.
Got it. So just in this past month of May, it's 19.7% over last year as a whole.
Yeah, May itself was a 28% higher, but overall, the year to the end of May is up 19.7% over last year's records.
Got it. And May, you said itself, 28% jump?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. So this is certainly some challenging times for a lot of families in particular, I would imagine.
Exactly. When those who were, you know, maybe managing on their own and then get hit with higher gas bills, higher grocery bills, you know, everything's kind of gone up, it's really starting to impact them. We are seeing, like I said, a significant increase this year than what we've seen in the past. And we're making records on records kind of thing. So this isn't just a bump that we've, you know, we're up a little bit. We're up a lot over a record year last year.
Would that be presenting challenges to meeting this increased demands?
Potentially. So far, we're managing to meet it all. I'm not sure where the growth is going and what that's going to look like.
Okay. At this point, you know, you're still being able to meet the demands of the community.
Yes, we are.
Okay. Good news for sure.
Yes, that's the happy news.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, if this is a continued trend, this definitely could present some significant challenges down the road, I would imagine.
Yeah. We had planned on a fair amount of inflation just based on information we'd received from Feed Ontario, our Ontario Association, and Food Banks Canada, our Canadian Association. So we had kind of planned for a decent inflation level or increase, I should say. But the actual demand has kind of shocked us that it's this high.
And if people who...
Someone else to say it's an unprecedented high, it's truly...
Unprecedented. Thank you. Yes. And if people want to help out, have the means to help out, what's the best way that people can help out the food bank right now?
Great. So if they want to help out, if they want to do a monetary donation, it's quick and easy on our website, kingstonfoodbank.ca. And if they want to donate food, we've got a contactless donation bin at our back door at 140 Hickson, Monday to Friday during business hours. And many grocery stores across town have our bins as well if they want to drop something in one of those.
Excellent. Dan, thank you very much for sharing today. Is there anything else you would like to touch on before we wrap up?
If you could also add this, if there's anyone in the community that has a need, please call us, 613-544-4100.
you're on the air with Viewpoints. Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
The Sackville Memorial Hospital has been going through a rough patch. Sackville's emergency department hours were cut by two-thirds to just 8 hours per day about a year ago. In December, acute care beds at the hospital were converted into alternative level care beds for those awaiting placement in long-term care homes. This is mostly due to staffing issues and shortages. The patients are left hanging. But things seem to be looking up and improving. Some hope the ER situation could be partially resolved as soon as this fall. Horizon Health Network CEO John Dornan said they have to listen to the front line and change the way they administer things. More with Erica Butler, working at CHMA-FM in Sackville, Nova Scotia.
While the Sackville Hospital experienced a last-minute closure of its emergency room on Thursday, Horizon's CEO John Dornan told those gathered for the network's annual general meeting that staffing issues at the hospital have been improving and that the hours for the ER might see an increase in the not-so-distant future, possibly even this fall. Sackville's emergency department hours were cut by two-thirds to just 8 hours per day about a year ago last summer. Then in December, acute care beds at the hospital were converted into alternative level of care beds for those awaiting placement in long-term care homes. The province has a backlog of people awaiting placement in long-term care facilities. Horizon's annual report says the network averages about one quarter of all its beds allocated to alternative level of care, or ALC, patients. CHMA sat in on Thursday's AGM to ask Dornan whether the need for those transition beds would be an obstacle to the return of acute care to Sackville. And which was the bigger challenge, the staffing shortage or the need for transitionary ALC beds?
It is somewhat twofold, but mostly the first point, and that's lack of staffing, physicians and nurses, collaboration between the inpatient units and the emergency department. These issues are improving. We have had more staff join us. We have had better stability of our daytime hours in the emergency department. And frankly, we're looking forward to increasing those hours in the not distant future, possibly by the fall. But to look after inpatients, like acutely ill inpatients, we need 24/7 coverage. So that is our goal. I won't back away from that. And it's almost exclusively staff dependent. While Sackville Memorial has been a big contributor to the care of alternate level of care patients, they're not the only ones to own that responsibility. All of our regional hospitals have them. And by the same token, if there is appropriate cover-up, follow-up care for acute inpatients, then Sackville Memorial Hospital has not been determined to not do that. In other words, we hope to get back to that at some point in time.
CHMA also asked for an update on the situation with staffing at the Sackville Hospital. Here's Margaret Melanson, VP of Clinical Services, answering that question.
I can share with you that we have been very successful in our recruiting of nursing staff at the Sackville Memorial Hospital. In May, we have recruited a new nurse manager to that facility. And additionally, we have both LPN staff and registered nurses that have been recruited. Additionally, we have recruited new nurse graduates from this spring to join the staffing at Sackville Memorial Hospital. And those individuals will begin imminently and have their orientation completed before the end of the summer. So we are very pleased with the recruiting that has been undertaken, and we're feeling very confident that we will move quite quickly to be able to support overnight care by two registered nurses at all times in the facility, which will allow us to begin to reintroduce some acute care patients at that site. Additionally, there may be others who wish to speak about physician resources. There has been a great deal of intensity toward physician recruitment, both for the summer as well as longer term. And although we are certainly tenuous throughout the summer period, for the longer term, we are feeling very comfortable with our move in the correct direction and to be able to, by sometime hopefully in the fall, begin to increase the hours of service at the Sackville Memorial Hospital Emergency Department. So we are certainly in progress. Although I will say at this point, we are optimistic of the future.
Horizon spokesperson Chris McDavid says that the network has recently hired 4 graduate nurses and 3 patient care attendants. And this summer, Horizon has hired 2 licensed practical nurses, or LPNs, who are currently participating in a bridging course to become registered nurses, and also 2 nursing students and a personal care attendant. Horizon CEO John Dornan also gave a general update on the measures the network has been taking to address its system-wide staffing issues.
It's a complicated question, a complicated answer. We had to change the culture on our front lines. We have to make our hospitals places where people want to work. And up until recently, particularly with the COVID, it's not been a comfortable environment. A first early part of addressing that culture is to start to listen to people, listen to the front line. One of the things that they spoke of was being paid adequately. And now our pay scale is better than it would be. As I said earlier, we're more likely to bring nurses from Nova Scotia to here than the other direction. So that's one thing. The second thing is that Gail LaBelle, Chief Human Resources Officer, in addition to orchestrating listening sessions, has started a campaign whereby we reward New Brunswickers, including nurses and physicians, for successful recruitment. If someone joins us from Toronto or Ontario and fills a role that we need filled currently, such as nursing, that person is rewarded financially. Rewarded when the person arrives and reported, and rewarded again when the patient is here for a period of time. And so that is twofold. Number one, it helps us recruit. It allows our community to participate in recruitment. And number three, it helps change the conversation. If you're recruiting people, you're not going to speak poorly of the organization. You're going to concentrate on the positive things about Horizon. So those are a couple of initiatives, and they're starting to bear fruit.
That's Horizon CEO John Dornan speaking with Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. The Government of Canada reports that approximately 8,000 wildfires occur each year in Canada, burning 2.5 million hectares. And in British Columbia, they're once again preparing for what has become an inevitable season. Nobody wants to remember the apocalyptic summer of 2021, but experts say we should be planning ahead for the next record-breaking season, which usually lasts from May to September. The province of BC is shifting how it responds to wildfires, putting more emphasis on risk mitigation and preparation, along with reacting to fires when they happen. Len Uden is the Fire Smart Coordinator for the Columbia-Shuswap Regional District, a program funded by the province. He says citizens can do their part in preventing the spread of forest fires. More on this with Megan Dooling in Revelstoke, British Columbia.
People should be preparing for another major wildfire season, even with our mild, wet, extended spring. It may not be this summer, but Len Uden predicts in the next 3 years we'll see another record-breaking bad season.
So we need to stop thinking that what's this season look like, how much rain have we had, what are the temperatures, and adjust course based on this individual season, but instead look long-term. And if each of us had a plan over the course of the next 1 to 3 years to reduce our individual property risk, when inevitably we are threatened by a wildfire, we're ready.
Uden is the Fire Smart Coordinator for the Columbia-Shuswap Regional District.
I'm responsible for education, promotion, and working with residents to reduce property loss and damage as a result of wildfire.
The Regional District's Fire Smart program covers rural areas in Electoral District B, which encompasses Revelstoke. This spring saw an uptick in Uden's program after last year's fire season. The Fire Smart program teaches people how to make it less likely that their home and property will catch on fire from a wildfire. There's information on the Regional District website for those who want to do it themselves. People can also ask someone from the program to come and assess their property for free. Homeowners can apply for a rebate of up to $500 to cover the costs of doing the work to make their property safer.
Most people, there's still a very limited understanding of what actually causes home ignition. People tend to look across the street or look across the valley and say, wow, there's a lot of vegetation or there's a lot of coniferous forest or somebody needs to do something about the issue up in the hills or across the street, when most factors that will determine if your host survives or doesn't is inside of 10 meters of your own property. And there's still a very big gap in there as to what I would say the average residential or rural resident is aware of what those hazards are.
The BC government budgeted $90 million this year for the Fire Smart program. It's spending money to be less reactive to wildfires. That's according to the budget document released in February, which reads, funding will move the BC Wildfire Service from its current reactive model of wildfire response to a more proactive approach and allow it to work on all four pillars of emergency management: prevention and mitigation, preparedness, response, and recovery. Uden's program is funded by the province. In the 4 years since he took his role, he says every year BC is more supportive. The city of Revelstoke runs its own emergency management program, which is funded through a service agreement with the Columbia-Shuswap Regional District. David Moan has been the emergency manager coordinator for the past 3 years. Currently, the city does not have a Fire Smart program or any resources to offer homeowners who may want to mitigate the risk of their home catching on fire due to a wildfire.
We've been talking about that for a few years. It's never really caught on, so that is one thing that we definitely want to create more of a spotlight on and see if we can get a better Fire Smart program.
Moan says to check out the city's website for information about any emergency management questions. I'm Megan Doolin.
And with all the bad news these days, we end things on a lighter note where a little chocolatey love might make us feel better. Local chocolatier Tanya Kran is celebrating 10 years as a raw food supplier for Cortes Island. What began in the Andean Mountains of Ecuador has carried on into the development of a lineup of raw cacao products under the company name Blossoms. Kran was introduced to a raw cacao collective while living in a mindful community in Costa Rica, where she learned about a native cacao harvesting that was taking place in Ecuador. The chocolatier now produces the Love Bar, an oversized chocolate bar available in the stores on Cortes Island. Cortes Island, British Columbia, where Loni Taylor follows the journey of Blossoms chocolate founder Tanya Kran.
I connected with a group of people that work with a collective in Ecuador. I was down in Costa Rica at the time. They were really looking for ambassadors around the world to bring the message of cacao, is how they put it. And from their region, cacao is, it's the motherland. It's where the original seeds sprouted on the earth in this region. And most cacao that's in the market today is hybrided or it's plantation, which means they take the seeds and they take them to the different regions and plant them there, where these were just showed up in the ground. And then they've kept the lineage of these trees thousands of years. And so, yeah, that in itself was just so fascinating for me to make this connection with cacao from its motherland, but also the medicine that cacao offers in this, in its raw state and in its natural state. Their whole story and history was also very fascinating. And they only harvest a certain amount to make sure that they can replenish every year. And these are trees that are grown in the rainforest. They're not planted. So if a cacao tree sprouts, that's where it starts to grow, and they nourish it until it's ready for harvesting. But it actually prefers the canopy of the rainforest to grow in the shade. It's naturally grown in the shade. So even in plantations, they actually have to cover it with these big plastic tarps. all their stories talk about what cacao can offer the body, the heart, the mind, the spirit. It's all connected with, scientifically, they've been able to break apart all the different components of cacao. But naturally, it's just like this plant has been offered as a source of medicine for the body in many different terms. And it was so valued. In its time, it was used as currency. It was the form of currency for, I don't know, hundreds, thousands of years, where it was used as the trading income. And so it was quite abundant. Everybody had access to it. So there was a lot of abundance. And greatly, what was, I thought was so extraordinary about it is that cacao beans actually only last for about 3 years before they start to disintegrate. So it didn't make sense to hang on to your cacao beans, because eventually they would just fall apart. So they were circulated more. There was always enough. Everybody had an abundance of, because nobody was hoarding a whole bunch of cacao beans in a bank somewhere. They had to circulate it. So it made a lot more sense to use it as the currency, something that was biodegradable and had a shelf life, so that it wasn't being all stored somewhere in one big bank account. And traditionally, the shamans were the ones that really were the ones that consumed the cacao, because it brought on much altered states. And Ananda mind is another component in cacao, and it tends to, it's that blissful or joyful feeling that we get, and it can heighten our awareness and open us to many different facets and aspects of love. It was used in a lot of different spiritual ceremonies to enhance our connection to love on this planet, love of the beings on this planet, and to be able to see that this planet is actually a living being that we are a part of, and not just in control of.
Living in a remote island, I know just from my own research, there are so many challenges to running a food-based business here.
I do feel the only way it's really worked is that I don't run it like a business at all. I run it as part of my life, or part of my lifestyle. Yeah, I make direct contact with most of the stores. Like, I have a personable relationship with all the managers. And yeah, there's always challenges, and they're always flexible and open. And I've been really lucky and fortunate. It's been a lot of hard work, but at the same time, I feel like I've got so much support with what I'm doing, especially here on Cortez. The most support community and the stores on the island, and everyone's, yeah, letting me do my thing. And I think that that's the only way it's really worked, is everyone, even like the postmistress here on Cortez, she has to deal with all my big boxes. And sometimes the chocolate doesn't go out, and I don't want it to sit somewhere in the post office if it gets too warm. They're always flexible with trying to help me out. And yeah, it's been an interesting dynamic, but like I said, I don't try and run it like a business. It's like a lifestyle or a community project, and it seems to work much better that way. No pressure. And I really believe in the product too. I really feel like I am offering a type of medicine that can open the heart, and hopefully this is what I think we really need more in our society, is nourishing foods that make us feel good, so that we can respond to each other in a much more positive way.
And that's it for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our great team of journalists, Lonnie Taylor, Karim Musna, Megan Dooling, Erica Butler, David Gordon Kosh, and their national coordinator, Maureen McEwen. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassagne. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in collaboration with your local radio station. You can listen to all our present and past shows on canada-info.ca, canada-info.ca, even download them if you wish. Also, tune in to all the stories we can't play here on the same website, canada-info.ca. Happy to have you with us. See you next week.